Welcome back, friends. We are back with an unreleased gem from the podcast archives. Andrew became sick during the original recording of this episode, and it somehow got lost in the sauce. We planned on re-recording the entire episode, but after listening to it, I have to say, it's kind of perfect as is. Today's guest is Serene Michelle Dillman. She's been a friend of the podcast, and she's actually working on a docuseries called Take Me Out Feet First. Andrew will be featured in that documentary as well. And then we've also had four other guests on this podcast that will be featured in it. That includes Dana Nelson, Eileen Hammer, Roger Kligler, and Erica Gregorich. Serene and Andrew chop it up. They talk about what led her to creating the documentary. There's a fun story in there about how she secured the rights to Blackbird from Sir Paul McCartney and what she had to do to get a hold of him. This episode is filled with some great Andrewisms and the kind of insights that only Andrew could deliver. So I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did, and let's get into it.
Well, cool stuff, people. Today, exciting episode, everyone. We are here with Serene Dillman. Jump on in, Serene. We always like to start with our guests by having them tell us a little bit, maybe some personal stuff about yourself, any hobbies you want to share, or interests that you have. Tell us a little bit about yourself.
So I'm originally from New York City, and I moved out here about a little over 30 years ago. And I'm married to my cinematographer, who's just become my cinematographer, actually, after 30 years of marriage. And we have three children, 29, 26, and 18. And I'm a former ballet dancer, and now I do hip hop, and I play tennis, and I swim, and I like to stay active. I lift weights. I am happiest, I think, when I'm doing that or when I'm doing something creative. I really like thinking about beautiful pictures and mostly of people. I used to do still photography, and you'll see all my photography all around the house here. So those are my hobbies, and that's what makes me happy. And doing this podcast with you will probably make me happy too, because it's part of the documentary that we're working together on.
Yeah. Nice. That's a cool little intro. And as you mentioned, working a little bit on a documentary, and I will let our listeners know as well that we are on the road, people. We are currently in Santa Monica, California. Serene was kind enough to invite us into their home and host us for this episode, along with some other pieces that we're working on. And yeah, just being around this place, so cool. Really neat decorations. And I love all the pictures and portraits and just awesome stuff. So I can see that. Yeah, I feel like this place and atmosphere really represents you well. So it's awesome. And thank you again for having us. Tell us a little bit. You mentioned this documentary, and I feel like this is how we became connected. So fill us in and the listeners as to what that's all about, or at least just some pieces of it, however you want to kind of start off, if you don't mind.
Okay. Well, I'm a documentary film director, and I started out probably about 10 years ago with my first documentary, which was called Getting to the Nutcracker, which was a behind the scenes look at what it takes to do the Nutcracker Ballet. And then I did one about 5 years after that called The Fifth Dementia, about a band in LA made up of people with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and dementia. And then coincidentally, one of the women from that film was the wife of the violinist. Her name is Miriam, and she shares a name with my mom. And she and I became very close after that. And she knew that my mom had used medical aid in dying in 2017. And so she was a supporter with Compassion and Choices. And about about a year ago, she hooked me up with Compassion and Choices because that's what my mom had done, and she thought it would be something that I'd be interested in following through on. And it ended up being what we're working on, which is Take Me Out Feet First, a documentary, actually episodic now, about medical aid and dying. And Compassion and Choices was who put me in touch with you.
Yeah, cool. It's neat how it connects from your experience with dance and ballet and such. That's awesome. You mentioned your mom using the medical aid and dying medication and having that experience. Can you tell us a little bit about it? I didn't realize that it was in 2017, which is still, I mean, that's still pretty fresh. Do you mind telling us about what that experience was like and how that impacted you and your family and maybe some of those emotions as well?
Well, she was diagnosed very quickly after 10 months of back pain. She finally couldn't take it anymore and went to the doctor. She was trying to, you know what, Ray, that's, you want to let Danny out?
Oh, Danny.
She wants part of this.
She's such a sweetheart. Yeah, Daniela is Shireen's dog, and she is like the coolest pup ever. Old timer, real sweetheart. What type of dog?
She's a long-haired Jack Russell.
Long-haired Jack Russell. Yeah, she's a beauty. Give her a couple treats and she'll be your bestie.
Okay, she's out. She won't whine anymore. So, okay. So she went to the doctor. She called me.
And you said because she was experiencing back pain.
My father had, she was having trouble sleeping. And I think that was sort of the final straw. And so they went to the doctor and she called us on the way, my brothers and I on the way back, and said, I feel like I'm in an alternative universe right now. I was just diagnosed with stage 4 spindle cell sarcoma. And they gave her 3 months to live without any sort of treatment. And if she did treatment, they said it would only extend her life by maybe 2 months. And she had been formerly a social worker with terminally ill cancer patients, and she knew what her future held. So she opted out of any future treatment and knew the law in California had recently passed and dove headlong into that. Didn't even discuss it with us or my dad or anyone. She knew that's what she wanted to do, and she did it.
How long was the turnaround between the diagnosis and accessing the medication?
I believe the first doctor she met with was the first person to give her the diagnosis, so that he was on board. And then when she thought of it, when she discussed it, hi, Danny, with him, then they referred her. There was a 2-week waiting period then. That's no longer the case here. It's now 48 hours. But 2 weeks later, she met with someone else. They confirmed the diagnosis and the prognosis. And then she called us. We were actually traveling. And she didn't want me to cancel those plans. She was pretty firm about that. She said, you know, this is something you've had planned. I don't want you to cancel it. Just continue. And when you're back, we'll discuss it. So I kept in touch with her while we were traveling almost every day. And she finally said, when are you coming back? And I said, we'll be back August 7th. And she said, okay, I'm going to do it on August 9th. So we flew back into California on the 7th, drove up on the 8th. I sat with her pretty much for 5 hours that night and just talked, the two of us. And the next morning, the medication was delivered, and my brother was there with his wife, my mom's best friend, also named Miriam. There's a lot of Miriams in this story. Mm-hmm. My mother's brother came in from Florida, and Ray was there. My other brother, Eric, decided not to be there. His wife had also recently passed away 4 months before this of cancer with 2 young kids. So he just had enough and said goodbye over the phone, basically. And I shot the whole thing.
Wow. Yeah, that heavy stuff. Your mom, she seemed very adamant and I guess in a way determined to have that choice and have that right to access medical aid in dying. Why do you think she felt so strongly about using this medication? And tell us about why she might have felt that strongly.
Well, my sister-in-law, my brother's wife, who had passed away a few months earlier, had chosen not to use medical aid in dying and had suffered greatly. She was in a huge amount of pain. She had two young kids, understandable why she wanted to stick around for as long as she did. But she watched Silvina, was her name. She's from Uruguay. She watched her just in agony, and no amount of pain medication was helping. And I don't think she wanted to suffer like that. And she had, again, as I said, she was a social worker for terminally ill cancer patients, and she saw what that was like. And when you see that, you know, and just like I hope to show in the episodes with Take Me Out Feet First, it just, to watch someone in so much pain and suffering is why would you not give them that option? It's inhumane.
Yes, it's, and Daniela is here visiting me too. And I think a lot about my dog, Dora, and actually May 9th is when I had to put her down back in 2020. And she, you know, I brought her to the vet and said our goodbyes there. But it may sound silly, but I think of Dora and I think of our pets and how we show them this compassion. And I think that one of the greatest gifts that I gave Dora was a way out, because she had, ironically, had developed a brain tumor. She had been having horrible seizures. Her last day, she had 6 seizures that day. And the last one was like almost 6 minutes long. So, I mean, no quality of life at this point. Anyways, I don't understand fully, I guess, how we show this compassion to our animals, yet there's all this controversy with people. And we were talking earlier, and ultimately, I think what's so important is just having the choice and the right to this option is what's so important to myself. And I think someone like you as well.
I think also, you know, you're so young. This should not be a conversation you're having right now. And I know the statistics from Compassionate Choices are that I think it's 75% of the people that use medical aid in dying are older. So the conversation is much more palatable to have. But to tell someone like you, who might be suffering to the point where you don't want to stick around anymore, who the fuck has the right to tell you what to do and when to decide that? And why shouldn't you be surrounded by your family and your loved ones and your friends and being happy in your last days? Why would you choose to go through debilitating and possibly unsuccessful treatment and have a quality of life that is not happy in your last months of life? Why not enjoy and not have that suffering? Why are we even having this conversation?
Yeah, I agree. And I appreciate that fire and that passion. It's obvious that you, you feel strongly about the topic, and that's what we need in terms of advocacy and moving this thing forward. Cause this is a right that I think all people should be afforded, especially when in the position of being sick with a terminal disease. You mentioned the documentary. Tell us a little bit about that and how it got started.
So, my mother and father lived on a top of a mountain in Marin called Mount Tam, and they had a view of the bay, and it was really pretty. And when they moved in there, she said, "I'm never leaving this unless I'm going out feet first." And, that's why we named it Take Me Out Feet First, because she got her wish. And I feel like everyone should get their wish, and whatever that is, there's no one that can tell you to do otherwise, because it's your wish. Once my mom used it, I sort of put it aside and didn't really want to revisit it for a while. And then when Miriam introduced me to Compassion and Choices, they were interested in having me speak to their storytellers. So I went on their website and I read through all of them. There were quite a few. And of those, I probably was interested in talking to about 50, maybe. And I Zoomed with a bunch of them. And of those, I narrowed it down to probably about 20, 25 people. And have been traveling around the U.S. since June of last year, so 2021, shooting all these people. And it's been so incredibly inspiring. You know, people hear about the topic and they think, oh God, you know, you want to slit your wrists. And it's the opposite. I feel inspired. I feel energized. I feel like the people I've met are so cool and so full of life, even though they're terminal, and because they're choosing to advocate for this very wonderful cause.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Can you tell me what that is that happened to you?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, we took a little pause for a second. And it's because I was getting what I call the watery mouth, watery mouth. And whenever I'm about to vomit, I always get like a lot of saliva building up. And then I have to keep spitting because I'm about to throw up. And then I usually throw up. But anyways, it's almost like there's so much saliva, it's like water is pouring out of my mouth. Yeah, people who are listening might experience this at some point or have it, whatever. But yeah, watery mouth, that's a big sign that I'm about to hurl. So had to get out of there for a second, but did not hurl.
Do you feel better?
Yeah, it comes and goes. And I've got some good meds that usually help with this stuff. It's really unpredictable. I was saying when I was in the bathroom, it's just a weird day. I haven't felt like some of these symptoms in a couple of weeks, it seems like. But
does smoking help?
Oh, yeah. Yep, it does. I figure after our discussion,
yeah,
enjoy a little, maybe a bowl. It definitely helps with the nausea and the stomach. That's certainly something. And people... I'm not sure if they realize some of those benefits, but for me, and even before I had gotten sick with cancer, it was something that always really helped with nausea or stomach ache. Mm-hmm. And certainly since being sick, it's been a useful tool to have.
It did not work with my mother. We tried, we got her like chocolate and it didn't help her pain.
Did she smoke it or just ate it?
No, she ate it like gummies and chocolate.
Right.
Is there a difference?
Yeah, there is. I think it's kind of like almost a different drug. I'm not saying it would have made a difference, but it could.
Well, that's interesting.
I do find a big difference between edibles and flowers. I think edibles can be a lot more unpredictable in terms of what the experience is like and how potent or effective they can be. Whereas I think with flower and smoking cannabis, it's pretty much, you know what you're going to get.
What do you call it? Cannabis now? I got to say pot, marijuana. I feel like an old lady saying
pot,
that.
Pot, weed, marijuana. Yeah, weed. Oh, yeah. Yeah. There's tons of names. It's all good. Yeah. Well, cool. Tell us more about you were going around the United States and you've been talking with lots of people who have a terminal disease. What have you... Do you notice any trends or any similarities between these people and whether it has to do with them and their disease itself or maybe related to medical aid in dying or similarities between family functions or experiences? Anything you notice, I guess, like a certain trend among everybody?
I think the thread is that everyone has like a real pissed off side that they're even having this conversation. Kind of like we are, you know, it's why do we have to fight for this? If this is our lives, why does anyone have a say in this? And unfortunately, it's because of the Catholic Church. It's the only reason that there's that conversation. In Massachusetts, I know you spoke to Roger Kligler. He's fighting the Catholic Church. In Montana, even though it's not illegal there. And we spoke to a woman whose son used it, who will profile in one of the episodes. Actually, his grandfather got the law to say that it was not illegal. So he but died the day before actually that it became legal. And the grandson was able to use it when he was diagnosed with, I think it was a pancreatic cancer. from working in a bug spray factory. Oh. Yeah. Anyway, they're pissed off. They're pissed off that anyone is even considering being against this for any reason. And the whole argument that they use is that, you know, God brought you into this world. God's going to take you out of this world. But not everybody believes that. And why would you push? You don't push your religion on other people. Why would you push your judgments or your feelings or your tenets or whatever it is that you do on other people? And I mean, we see that's what's happening now with the abortion debate in this country. It feels like we're going back to the time of the pilgrims.
Yes, it's alarming some of the trends we're seeing with the body autonomy and some of those similarities. I think we were discussing there are those parallels between something like abortion and medical aid in dying, where we're talking about body rights, and for whatever reason, lots of people get involved, even though it really would not have any impact on them personally. And I'd say majority of the cases, mm-hmm. if I were to use medical aid in dying, because as I continue dying from this disease of cancer, I don't know how it's going to really impact the Catholic Church. I mean, come on now.
Yeah.
But and it's interesting you mentioned that specifically the Catholic Church, because throughout our experience with this podcast, that's certainly something that I've noticed when talking with others. It always seems to go back to these large organizations, specifically Catholicism, and they have a serious grudge with this idea.
Well, the reason that they're successful with their anti-legislation for this is because they have money. Mm. And even Compassionate Choices, which has quite a big budget for their advocacy, I think they have like over 20 million. The church can, you know, quadruple that. So you can't, they're small time compared to the Catholic Church. So they can throw as much money as they want into a PAC, which is legal, and that PAC can support a legislator or a senator, and they can sway the vote. And so that's, you know, why you have to name these people. You have to say so-and-so, you know, how much money did you get? And why are you voting this way? Is it because you got this much money? Or did the people that you're representing send you here to vote this way? I mean, you have to embarrass people, I think. And ultimately, it's different. The abortion conflict is different because not everyone in this country is going to have an abortion, but everybody is going to die. And at some point, you're going to want to have this option in your life, whether you know it or not. And then you don't have to use it. You know, we were just talking about Dana, who I know you had a podcast with. Dana is a huge advocate in Minnesota for medical aid in dying, and she's already said she doesn't think she's going to use it. She just wants the option if the pain gets to be too bad.
Yes, and to me, that's the most important piece, and we've mentioned it over and over and over again, but just having the choice, having the option, it's not for everybody. Totally understandable, and I can respect that. Doesn't bother me if it's not for you. I'm not going to try to convince you, right? But it's about having that choice and that option, which is what's so important. Out of all the places that you've been during your experience with your docuseries, what's, I guess, a place or an area or an individual that really stands out to you? Something really memorable through your experience?
This woman, Mimi Ankerholtz. Her name's Andrea, but everybody called her Mimi. She was from Colorado. And I had Zoomed with her, and I knew I was going to go talk to her in person because she's really funny. She had a great sense of humor. And I think, to me, having a sense of humor, it just makes everything so much easier. I love to laugh, and she made me laugh more than anyone. And she really did. She was hilarious. We were back east because we go every summer back east to visit friends. And we were supposed to be there for a few weeks. And Mimi called me and she's like, well, if you want to shoot me, you better do it now because I'm out of here. And so we cut our vacation short and we flew to Colorado and we shot with her. And then the day after we shot with her, she used medical aid in dying. And now her husband, Jesse, who's the widower, is coming out here next week to stay with us for 4 days. And here's a really cool story. as it relates to Mimi. She had a blackbird tattooed on her arm. Her husband, Jesse, has a gigantic black, only one tattoo, gigantic on his chest. And she has, I think, five kids. All of them have a blackbird somewhere on their body, on their fingers, on their back, on their arm. And they've all sent me pictures of it. And I said, well, what's with the blackbird? And she said, well, I love the Beatles and I especially love this song, you know. And I said, what lyric? Like, what about the song? And she said, well, what was it, Ray? Take these broken wings. Oh, my God, I'm going to cry. And learn to fly so she wouldn't be in pain anymore. And so so she said when she takes the medications, it still gets me. She was going to play Blackbird. And then the day after she died, all of her friends and family were going to time it so that they all played Blackbird at the same time in her memory. So I was like, fuck, now I got to get the rights to Blackbird for her episode, right? And I worked since her day, since she died, I worked so hard to try and get this and nobody would give me the rights. I tried going up the ladder at Sony ATV. I tried personal connection with someone at a publishing company. I tried everything. And finally, I got to the very top of Sony, who has the rights. And the guy called me. He was so nice. And he's like, I'm really sorry, but this song is on hold for another project for the rest of the year. So we can't give it to you. He said, but the only way you might be able to get the rights is through Paul himself. I was like, oh, great. Right. Now, what am I supposed to do? So I've actually been friendly with Burt Bacharach for about 30 years.
Nice.
And his wife, Jane.
Very cool.
And must so I called Jane. No, well, he didn't write Blackbird, unfortunately. So I called Jane and Burt and I said, do you have any connection to Paul? And they were like, not really, but our son Oliver does if he's friends with Mary McCartney. So I was like, okay. And Oliver is my son's age. He's like a total snowboarder dude. I love Oliver, but they call him Sharky. He lives in Colorado. He's a cool guy, but he's just like wild, right? So I wrote this 3-page impassioned email to Oliver. This is Mimi. This is her story. This is the Blackbird thing. Your mom told me you were friendly with Mary. Is there any way you could forward her this email and maybe she sends it to Paul? So he writes back. He's like, oh, I was just talking about Kevorkian with my doctor. He had just had this conversation. He's like, this is so cool. I love this story. I'm sending it to Mary. Cool. So he sends it to Mary. Mary doesn't respond like for a week and I'm like biting my nails. And so I write to Oliver. I said, did you hear? Have you heard anything? Do you want to follow up? And he's like, no, just give her some time. But I guess he did follow up. And he just said, did you get my email? Apparently his email went to spam. Mm. She wrote back, I'm so sorry I missed this, but I'm sending it to my dad now. She sent it to him. The next day, Paul wrote back, you can use it.
Whoa, nice. Cool. That is so awesome. Yeah.
He's like, I love this idea. And we were going to have, or we did have this 17-year-old boy who's a guitarist and singer sing it. So
I was going to ask, can you do that? Like, even if you just had someone like the 17-year-old do that, you'd have to get the rights.
You still have to get the rights.
Okay.
Yeah. So we had Sam Wood, this guy, do it. I can play it for you so you can let your listeners hear it.
That'd
a beautiful,
be
beautiful rendition.
I love it.
Of Blackbird. And so this ends her Mimi's
wow.
episode.
Wow. Did I ever show you this? I think it was covered the last time.
All you
time.
Need is love.
Yeah, they got a little bird. Whoops, sorry. Little bird on there, too.
Yeah, I forgot about that.
Blackbird was like one of the first Beatles songs I played for my first group of students. And I have a good buddy of mine whose girlfriend at the time created this really cool stop motion video of a blackbird just going around.
You showed
around.
Me that.
Yeah, you showed me that.
I remember seeing
and,
that.
And yeah, so I love that song. And I just think it's kind of cool that you shared that story. Yeah, what a powerful thing.
Oh,
and music,
so
right? I mean, what a
okay, so there's,
powerful thing.
There's a little more.
Sure, finish. Please tell
so,
us.
So Paul McCartney's on tour right now. And he's coming here to LA next week.
Oh, cool.
And Jesse's visiting next week. And we got him a ticket.
Nice.
So he doesn't know yet.
Oh, wicked.
But I'm going to shoot him when we tell him. And then obviously when Paul sings Blackbird, because he always does.
Yeah.
We'll shoot Jesse listening to it. I think it's going to be pretty emotional.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I just love how that story came around.
Yeah. And totally. I mean, just talking about coming together there, all those pieces, right?
Everybody has a song that they love, mm-hmm. you know, and it always comes out when I talk to them. And it just, yeah, I wasn't going to take no for an answer for that. You can't have this episode without that song. It's too
That's perfect. Incredible. Yeah. I'm really happy to hear that. Yeah. And how cool of Paul. Mm. That I guy mean, is.
Well, you know, his wife, Linda, died of cancer. So I think he was kind of moved by the whole story.
Sure. Wow. Yeah, he was in San Diego a few years back. And this was a while ago. He still kills it, that guy. He's impressive. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. We saw him too the last time he came through here. It's just
very cool.
Yeah. It's wonderful.
Well, follow up. Let us know how the concert goes and everything. It's going to be a really special experience.
Well, you should play the song at the end of this podcast.
Yeah. I love it. We'll
Instead
have to
of
do
your jazz
that can
song.
Be our, yeah. Yeah. We'll have to do like maybe on the way out. My uncle, that's my uncle actually. He's a jazz musician. And that's one of, one of the tunes he wrote. Yeah, that's why I wanted to use it, kind of keep, you know, use some of his talent, share some of that. Mike Flack, guy can jam.
It's good. It kind of sticks with you.
Yeah, it is good. It's unique. I feel like now when you hear that, you're going to think of this pod, you know, so it's cool. But yeah, that'd be great. We can maybe end on that tune. We'll kind of have that. And the outro, what would you call that? The exit? The outro. Excellent.
Do you have any sense of what your numbers are for your listeners yet? Like, can you track that?
Yeah.
Yes. We'll we can. And Hasbaum would know more and have probably better access to the data, I guess. I think we've had, 3,000?
Yeah, over 3,000 downloads.
3,000 downloads or whatever, which means I believe that's people basically like playing... hitting play essentially. And then we do have other data that shows like how much of the episode they listen to and different pieces like that. So yeah, it's a slow moving project. I think, I mean, I'm surprised with that number, to be honest. I didn't really know if we'd have anybody listen to this. So it's been pretty cool.
I have a suggestion. Compassion and Choices has a very big reach. And if you're helping them, they can help you.
Yeah.
So they need to put something about you on their website. And
yeah, we've done a couple good projects together for sure. I did one of their storyteller things. Right. They gave us a couple retweets. It's so hard for me. I'll go on this rant for a second. We have a Twitter account for our podcast, and I'm still on the fence of whether or not we're going to get rid of it or not, because I've spent some time on Twitter. I'm not on any social media anymore. I got rid of that stuff probably in 2015. And I started using the Twitter for our account. And this is obviously a little, well, it is on topic of medical aid and dying. And obviously you try to follow certain people or topics or whatever, trends, all that. And it seems like Twitter kind of then gears you towards more of that community. So all of our stuff on medical is about medical aid and dying and following different people. I don't know. Long story short, I guess I was really disappointed in the amount of negativity I found down there. Oh my gosh, it was incredible. And to me, it outweighed the amount of positivity that I was seeing. So I ended up deleting it from my phone and kind of just said, and Hasbaum and his team do a great job of producing clips and audio files for us to put on Twitter, but it was just too much. I couldn't do it.
What kind of negativity?
Everything from people arguing with each other on the topic of medical aid and dying to other people who have cancer and talking about, you know, their experiences with it, which was overly negative. And that's okay. I understand at times you got to vent and get that stuff out there. For me, it just was too much. It wasn't my style and it wasn't doing any good for me. It just was negative and sad and I didn't like being a part of it.
I don't blame you.
Yeah. So the social media piece, I get it that it's taking over our world and there's no escaping it. Right. But for me, I'm,
much happier without that stuff.
Well, I don't necessarily think you should go back to social media. I just think that Compassion and Choices should do their part to get the word out on your podcast.
I definitely agree with you, because if you think about it, not like we planned on doing it, but it's one of the more like comprehensive podcasts about medical aid and dying. We've had almost every type of like person, you know, expert on the topic come on and talk about it.
Yeah. Well, I'm sure that is a possibility.
I'm going to take care of that for you.
Go for it. Yeah, that's fine. But tell us a little bit more about your documentary and tell us like about how it impacted you and your family. You mentioned you have three children. So did they have perspectives, and how did they feel knowing like your mother went that route and such?
Well, it's not the, as I said, since you're so young, this is hard, you know, to have this conversation with a young person. It's mostly an older person, like my mom. I think that my kids knew nothing about the whole concept of medical aid in dying. And they went up and they said goodbye to her. They weren't there at the time that she did it, but they all spent time with her alone in the weeks before she decided to do it. And that was really nice time that they all had together. Don't think that they really thought about the whole, like we never really had a whole conversation about it. And I think it might speak to the relationship they had with her. You know, I feel like when you're really, really close with someone and they feel strongly about something, then you have the conversation for a long time. And she didn't have that conversation with any of her kids, with her husband, with, you know, my dad. She just was so sure of herself that this is what she wanted to do and how she wanted to go. And I think the point that I think is important that came out of that is it seemed a little selfish on her part. I would never want to change her mind, and I would never have tried to talk her out of it. I think it's a great thing that she had this option and that she avoided chemo and her pain and suffering. I do think it would have been nice to involve everyone with the whole concept of medical aid in dying, why she chose to do that and how it made her feel and why it was a good thing for her, instead of kind of just saying, this is what I'm doing, goodbye. So if it were me, I would have gotten my family together, maybe would have taken a vacation, maybe we would have all sat around and talked about, you know, why I would want to do it, and this is the diagnosis, and this is what my prognosis would be, and this is what I would have to go through. Do you want to see me suffer like that? Do you understand why I don't want to do that? And just sort of flesh it out, you know? And I think my dad had the worst time of it after she left, because he felt bereft. He felt left. He felt like he had never made peace with that whole concept. And for many, many years after, I would interview him for the documentary, and he would say, I don't know how she had the courage to do that. I would never have the courage to do that. And she never consulted me, and I'm angry about that. I miss her too much. You know, they had a 58-year marriage. So I think that's, in terms of my kids, what I would do differently and probably what they would want to have done differently.
Yes, I agree. I think having those discussions and dialogue can be helpful for everybody involved, because it seems like it's definitely not always just about that one person. In most cases, usually there's family and others involved, so it can be helpful.
I think what you're doing is you know, totally commendable in terms of you're involving all your sisters and your mom and dad, and everybody's on board with this, and they all know what your wishes are and they support you. And that must be great for you to have that support, but also great for them knowing what the future will eventually hold, and they can prepare for it and they can prepare their families for it. And there's strength in that.
Yes, I agree. It's been, I think, one of the greatest pieces of medical aid in dying is having that ability to kind of plan and prepare. And
know that if it's needed and if that's a decision you decide to make as a person who's sick, that it's there and you can be with the people that you care about and love the most. And it was very important for myself to have those discussions with my family. And I think as I'm sitting here talking with you as well, I'm realizing that checking back in and kind of revisiting some of those topics is important too. And that's something I want to try to do a better job of, is just making sure to stay open with how I'm feeling and where things are at with the disease and things like that. I always say it's kind of a slippery slope with cancer. It seems like some days you might be feeling good and then all of a sudden you start getting sick, the watery mouth, and then you're throwing up and then you're in the hospital, right? I don't think that's in store for me this weekend. I'm pretty sure I fended it off. But with that, it's like, how many times can you keep doing that, right? For example, when I had talked with my oncologist years ago, this was December of 2020, when we first got on the topic of medical aid in dying. I had been in the hospital for a pretty severe kidney infection, and he was basically saying these stents would become more prevalent and harder to come back from. And that's kind of, I shared with him my fears of not being able to die. I'm afraid my body just won't die. I can be pretty damn stubborn, and I could see how subconscious piece of myself is just saying, like, no, it's not going to happen. But that's how I learned about that option, and I think it's for me, it's very important to have. So I was kind of rambling for a second.
Well, the most important thing for me when I'm shooting all these people that are storytellers with Compassionate Choices is their story. That's what's interesting to the public. That's what's interesting to my audience. They want to see each individual story, and they're all different. They're so different. And that's what makes it compelling. It's not my story. It's your story. So it's okay to go on like that and embellish and sure, whatever you're thinking and whatever you're physically feeling. And I mean, that's what's interesting. People want to know.
Yeah, it's quite the journey being sick with this disease and in these positions. I wanted to ask, regarding all these different people that you've interviewed, how many have used the medication and are still alive, to be blunt?
I don't know. I actually haven't actually counted.
Right.
I can tell you some of the stories. I know Lee was one of the women that Roger talked about from Massachusetts who had to move to New Mexico. And I had hooked Lee up with Erica, who you also interviewed, right?
Yeah. She was awesome.
In Arkansas.
I got to text her back. I just realized
she's
that.
Great. Yeah, smart lady.
She's so cool.
Her mom's really smart too. I had a Zoom call with Roger, Lee, Erica, and is there someone else? Roger, Lee, Erica. Oh, I guess it was just me. And because Lee was trying to get the law passed, helping Roger get the law passed in Massachusetts, it was supposed to pass. They spoke to the politicians. They all promised they would vote that way. It came out of committee, and then it went away. So Lee, I mean, talk about angry. She was spitting mad. And so I organized this Zoom call with everyone, and Erica ended up helping Lee and her husband, Paul, find a place in New Mexico because there's no residency law there.
Right.
And that's where she did it. So we ended up, we shot with Lee, I think it was in July, and she ended up doing it in, when was it? This year.
Yeah, recently, year. I think February, yeah. Maybe. January, yeah. February.
Yeah. So, but she's an awesome, funny lady. And so she used medical aid in dying. There's a guy named Matt, who was also a storyteller for Compassionate Choices. And Matt Fairchild had melanoma. And actually his widow, Ginger, and I are having dinner next week.
Cool.
And since his death, we have kept in touch, and I'm going to film it. So Hannah Olivas also is an advocate in Nevada, and she has blood cancer. And so she's coming in for some treatment next week. And so she and Ginger and Matthew, when he was alive, were friends. So we're all having dinner together and we're going to shoot that too, to sort of do a follow-up. So I feel like all of these people that I've interviewed, I've in some way become close to and still stayed in touch with and still care about and still want to know what's going on with them. And that's kind of what this has done for me, in that it's given me a community of like-minded people who are all over this country who are advocating for the same thing in different ways in different states. And in terms of who has used the medication, I'd say probably 6 out of 20 so far.
Okay. You mentioned one of your favorite parts is just getting to know these people and hearing about their story. One of the trends or patterns that seem evident for people who may be considering using this medication is that, and I know speaking for myself, obviously, that I do very much want to be alive. I want to be able to go play hockey and video games and walk to the beach and such. Whereas, and this is where I think some people mix up some of the lingo, especially, which is very something that we've talked about, a little trend we've noticed. Oftentimes, some people may mix up the idea of medical aid in dying with something like physician-assisted suicide or euthanasia or whatever you want to call it. And I guess one of the biggest pieces that I have been trying to share or help people understand is that a lot of us, we really want to be alive, right? It's not like I don't want to die at all, but I don't have a choice in this matter, unfortunately, because I have this terrible disease. People who are proponents or against the bill or this idea often try to say that it's similar to suicide and that people don't want to live. Basically, my question is, do you notice that same trend? Do you notice a strong will to live in the people that you've been talking to who are even still considering using medical aid?
There's no one, not one person that I've talked to that doesn't want to live. That's not even it's not an argument. Fuck that. I don't even want to go there. I mean, it's like so stupid. Why would you say to someone like you? Has anyone actually had the nerve to say that to you?
No, not to me.
No, I don't think so. And I don't think anyone I've talked to have been confronted in that way at all either. It's all in the politic. You know, there's no, it's not a person. You're not going to have someone come up to you and go, you know, you're going to hell and you're committing suicide and shouldn't be your choice. Nobody's going to do that.
Yes, that's kind of what we're finding is, even when we're talking with people who do hold strong religious beliefs, they personally don't have much of an issue with someone who's using this medication. It just goes back to
most of the people that I've talked to are religious, for sure. Mm-hmm. And it's completely separate. It's not even part of their conversation. I mean, even Dana's family is very, very religious. When we shot with her in December, the entire house was lit up like a Christmas tree. I mean, it was, you know, all Christmas, Christmas, Christmas. And I feel like, you know, Dana is a full on atheist because of her illness, but her parents aren't. But they're still very supportive of her. They want her to not be in pain. Everything that she does, they are with her every moment of the day to keep her out of pain. And they're living it with her. They would never stop her from doing something like that if that was her choice. I don't think it's going to be her choice. She's one of the few that probably won't use it. But at least she wants to have the option, and her parents want her to have that option. I mean, they've seen her. She's had the liquid pumped out of her body 3 times this week already because she's so distended. She's in for 5 days right now in the hospital for another chemo round, which is kind of the last ditch effort.
Yeah. Yeah. When we were talking with her, she was really fighting hard, and there's just so much that comes with these diseases, and when you progress with them and when they're uncurable, it just gets worse and worse. One thing my oncologist said to me, and it's been resonating with me lately, is that there is no finish line with this. It's not like one day I'll go to see him and we'll say, all right, I'll see you never, you're done now, buddy. Mm-hmm. Have a good life.
Yeah, I'm not including in any of these episodes the other side. I have no interest in giving them any space or any time or any. I mean, I'm not. They shouldn't be heard, as far as I'm concerned. It's only your voice and the other voices of the people that we're talking to. I that's why it makes me so angry, because it just shouldn't even be part of the conversation.
Yeah, we got a lot of work to do, even though we live in the United States and we are built on these ideas of freedoms and self-determination and autonomy. It seems like sometimes things like religion really impede those rights.
I think that in showing the human side and the personal stories that I'm going to hopefully show, that people will have that empathy and compassion to see why it's necessary. And you don't need to show the other side's argument, because it really doesn't have anything to do with those people or their stories. It's nothing to do with it. They're not even thinking about it or considering it.
Yeah, I think that's why the documentary is so cool, too, is how you're really just focusing on the individual and their life and the cool experiences that they've had, and giving them a chance to share, you know, their story and how something like medical aid and dying is important at this time in their life. So it's good stuff.
Right. Yeah, I don't think it's been done before. I think any of the other movies, documentaries, or there have been a couple of episodes on some TV shows. I know that my neighbor, Debbie Allen, she directs Grey's Anatomy, and they did two episodes recently, I think last month, on medical aid and dying.
Interesting.
And so it's coming into the sort of public vernacular. People are talking about it. It's a very timely subject, and it's all the way it's being shown is in a good way. It's being shown in the humane way, and why it needs to be part of everybody's awareness, basically. And so I think if you constantly show the good side and people's stories and the heart of it, then maybe you'll get through.
Absolutely. Yeah. So for your documentary, tell us a little bit about like the format. I think I heard you refer to it as a docuseries.
Yeah. Well, in the past I've only done films, but this, I have so much footage that it's impossible to do, you know, a 90 minute or 2 hour film. It would not do everybody's story justice.
Sure.
So we decided to break it up into different episodes, and I don't know how many there'll be. I'm thinking 6 to 8.
That's rad.
And I'll shop it around. We're almost done with the pilot episode. Nice. With Mimi.
Cool.
And so I'll shop that around to the big streaming services and see who wants it, and then we'll go from there.
Very cool.
Yeah.
What do you think, thinking about the people you've talked to, what's the biggest takeaway that you've learned from this and from the others? Mm-hmm. And maybe it's something that has to do with the subject, or maybe it's just something that applies to other aspects of life.
Well, it seems like the people that I've talked to are living their lives, and that they don't want interference from negative sources. So everybody's very positive. You're very positive. Dan is extremely positive. Everyone's very sort of energetic and happy and living and earnest about their subject, about what they're going through and what they want. Roger has been doing this not for him, but he says he's doing this for everyone that follows him. Dana, same thing. She wants everyone that follows her to do it. Same with Mutchler in Montana. He died, but his grandson was able to take advantage of it. Look at Brittany Maynard. You know, Dan is traveling the country for Compassionate Choices, trying to spread the word that Brittany, you know, with Brittany's story. I think that there's such life to be lived, and to go through, to waste any, I'm sorry, I think religion is a total waste of time anyway, but to go through life trying to change other people's minds towards your beliefs that may go against somebody else's. I mean, it's just such a waste of time and energy. And I think that's the biggest takeaway, is that it's just a big fucking waste of time. And to just, and you have to live your life the way you want to live and be happy and do what you want to do. And if anyone gets in your way, just push them out and don't let them get in your way.
I dig it. I dig it.
Even if it's a family member.
Yeah, that can be tough, especially with the family piece.
Because that's something I've run across as well. And
you noticed family members who may not agree with the individual who might use the medication? Have you had an experience during your investigating and docu-series?
Yes. But those people sort of keep it to themselves. I mean, they've made the person aware, but they keep it to themselves because they know that it's basically none of their business. It's not their life, right? So they're still supportive, even if though they may not agree with it. There's one woman in Michigan, and her name is Trisha, and she is one of like five kids from a very, very religious family. And she, while we were there shooting, her mother came out and started yelling at her about how God didn't want her to end her life. And it was up to him what she did with her life. And she just was like, "Mom, go back in your room and be quiet." I mean, it was kind of funny, but she was right. She's like, this is her decision. She's the one going through breast cancer. She had a breast removed. She's going through chemo again now. And we sat and talked with her brother and her sister, both of whom are religious. And they sat with her on the couch and they said, "We don't agree with this. We don't think, you know, that this is something that God would approve of, but she's our sister and we love her and we'll support her in this." So they, despite their religious beliefs, are supporting her. And that's for her. That's enough. For Trisha, that's enough. And it's, she's funny about it. You know, she's like, they said that they'll support her and be there for her. And she's like, "I don't want you there." She's like, "I'm going to do this myself. I'm donating my body to science." She's like, "I might just get in my car, drive to close to the lab, call them and say, come pick me up and then do myself in with the medication." She's got the whole thing planned out. And she's donating her body to science. And that's the best way to get it there. Because if she does it further away, her body might not be ready, you know, for science. I mean, she's got the whole thing sorted out. So everybody's got what they want to do. And it's nobody else's business. Despite the fact that they may not agree and their family members, they're still supporting her. And I mean, we were laughing about it. Again, the role of humor is really good.
Yes. Yeah, you got to be able to laugh at things.
Alcohol helps too.
Do you think that there is a problem in this country when talking about death and dying? Do you think people are afraid of the topic or try to push it aside?
Do you?
Yes.
I mean, do you try and push it aside, or were you afraid of it?
I've always been very curious about what happens when you die. I remember being very young and wondering exactly that.
Has your view changed at all?
I think my relationship with death has gotten better. I don't think I'm really afraid. I feel very prepared and just understand that we all will have this experience at some point. I always worry more about who I'll leave behind. But I've recognized through this process just how strong and loving and pretty cool my family is, and my friends as well. And I know everyone's going to be just fine. Of course, it's difficult, right? Anytime you lose somebody, it's hard, especially, you know, somebody younger who dies of a disease like this. But I take solace knowing that this is just part of some divine plan that is probably far too comprehensive for us to understand. But who knows? Maybe I'm just saying that to feel better. I don't know. But
well, it seems like there is a path that people follow, and there is a fear of death, and there's a fear of talking about death. But then once it becomes more commonplace, like I've been talking about it now for a year, so it's definitely become easier for me to talk about. I might still be afraid of death, because I'm not sick. So I think the people that I've talked to are not afraid of death anymore. Nobody's afraid of it. They're, to a person, have said, I'm not afraid to die. So there must be some line that you cross to get there. And I don't know what that is yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I think so. I noticed for myself, at times I'll kind of envision and wonder what that experience will be like, whether I'm using this medical aid and dying medication or not, but the concept of death. And prior to, I guess, one of the signs where I can tell I feel more comfortable is before, when I would fantasize about that situation, I'd always notice some kind of really small physical sign. For example, my heart might skip a beat, or the hairs on my arms stand up and get the goosebumps. And now when I think about these things and that process, it's, hey, I'm cool as the other side of the pillow, just ready to go. So I think that's certainly a sign that I'm more comfortable at some of those lack of physical signs, I suppose. And just also, when you talk this much about this subject, I mean, we've got so many episodes at this point, and I think it's free therapy in itself, talking with these different professionals and different people like Dana as well. I thought we really connected. That was the first time I've talked with someone who's kind of more in my age bracket and has a terminal disease. So it was powerful. And then hearing stories from you as well, and how we are all connected in a way. And diseases like cancer, they impact everybody. I think we all, and those who are listening, whether you personally have had this disease or just know someone or a family member, it impacts all of us. So these discussions are important to have and consider at some time. And they don't necessarily have to be really morbid and sad and everything, right? I mean, yeah, we can laugh and joke and have some fun with some of this stuff. And I think, if anything, it's an opportunity to grow and learn more about yourself and prepare for what is certainly inevitable. So if anything, I hope with this podcast that maybe people do feel more comfortable with death and dying, and their relationship might change for the better. So
might be interesting for you, once you sort of get a bigger base, to have a Q&A podcast one day. Just say, anybody who's been listening to this, if you have any questions, we're going to spend 2 hours just answering the phone, and or if you would prefer to email it or text it or whatever, here's a number. Because some people don't feel comfortable talking about it, but once they get the question out, then they are more engaged.
Sure. Yeah, that would be neat. Yeah, next week we're excited. We're going to go talk to a couple chaplains from UCSD who work with the palliative team. So this will be pretty cool. It's one of the first, I guess, more religious type people that we'll be interviewing. Mm-hmm.
I interviewed a ex-Catholic priest
for
this, and it was really interesting. He's completely changed. I mean, he's opposite of what, I mean, I have pictures of him in the black robe doing whatever
it's got the collar.
The collar, but also the, you know, like he was doing something with
human sacrifices.
Yeah.
There was a goat and some blood. I remember that from grade school. Yeah.
Tongues, like forked tongues.
Speaking tongues, all that.
And he's completely for medical aid and dying, and pro abortion, and pro, you know, gay marriage. Like, he's completely gone the opposite way. Because he saw in himself that he didn't believe what he was espousing. I think he was like in seminary school, and then he graduated, and then he was a priest for something like 11 years.
Wow.
And then he was leading some group of people, and he met a woman, and he fell in love, and he had sex, and he hadn't had sex before. Wow. And it was like the world opened up, and the heavens were like, whoa. <You know?
laughs> I'll do that. That's funny.
And it completely changed him. And he actually got excommunicated from the church or something. Yeah. There's a whole article. He gave me the magazine with the article in it on how he was excommunicated from the church.
So mind-boggling to me is the hypocrisy with some of these people and organizations. Let's be honest, the Catholic Church, you should be ashamed of yourself for a lot of the things that you've done. And you really have no place to decide, you know, whether or not people should have this option. It's very disturbing. Mm-hmm. But that's for a whole nother episode, I'm sure.
Or who should marry who, or who should have sex with who, or who should, you know.
I'll never get it. I'll never understand why some of these people or organizations need to be so involved in these intimate details of our lives.
I think people really like a set of rules to follow. And the church has a set of rules. And when you're fearful and you don't have a guide for yourself, you're like, oh, that makes sense to me. I'll go with this group. And then you're accepted in this group, not because of your character and who you are and how kind you are or how smart you are, for whatever reason your attributes are. You're only accepted because you believe the same thing, or you say you believe the same thing.
It is nice to be accepted. People want to be accepted.
It's weak. Yeah. It's fear. Yeah. It's fear, and it's fearful and weak, and that's, I think, what religious groups prey on, no matter what it is, whether it's Judaism, Catholicism, whatever they all are. You know, I think that they all prey on fear.
Yeah, I remember being very young.
Where's Christopher Hitchens when we need him?
I remember being very young and exactly that, afraid of making mistakes because I would think I'm going to go to hell. God is, you know, I being a little kid and thinking that, and like no little child should have to think that way. Mm-hmm. But I think I knew for myself early on that the organized religion piece was, you know, at that time and still is not something that fits for me. And that's okay. Everybody has different perspectives and experiences.
Well, you have a reasonable mind. You were trying to sort out all those silly stories, which is what Tricia said to me too. She said she was so indoctrinated into her 20s, and finally she was like trying to figure out the Noah's Ark story, and she's like, well, if there's two of them and then they had kids, but isn't that incest, and how does that work, and so you're screwing your cousin, like, oh, how, so their kids are screwing each other. Like, it didn't make sense to her. And then she started asking questions, and they're like, don't worry about it. You'll figure it out when you're older. And she never did. And so that was what she told that story. I mean, I'm going to put that in her episode. It was an aha moment for her that none of it made sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I have yet to interview or talk with anyone who has a terminal disease and won't use this medication because of their religious beliefs. That'd be interesting, though.
We're back.
Yeah, we're back. That was kind of, I think you mentioned, the first time that we were able to kind of pause and come back. Had to take a little break there to all the listeners. A little yard maintenance going on, which does not jive well with the podcast. I don't think you people want to hear the background of a tree being trimmed. That background noise. But we're back. We're live in this moment in time. and we're hanging out with Serene still. What a cool yard, by the way. This place is awesome.
Thank you.
Hasban, fill us in. You were on a good one just now.
Yeah.
Jump on in here.
You know, I really wanted to ask about the creative process a little bit. So I do think that this is an important topic, but because society has such a denial of death, they're not going to really want to listen about it, in my opinion. Mm. I mean, the denial of death goes pretty far. It might be, yeah, it's one of our drives, that, like, I think. And there's a book by Ernest Becker that is all about, like, how far our society goes into not thinking about it. So then, as a creative person, you have to make a docu-series or documentary about a very important topic that you feel passionate about. So, like, have you thought about, I guess, from your creative mind, how have you thought about this? Because I'm sure you've thought about this too. Like, how do I make this interesting? How do I make this something people want to watch? And while also, you know, paying tribute to the topic. So, yeah, I just wanted to know if you could fill us in and on how you're thinking about this from a creative angle.
And also, real quick, just to, and I maybe I'm not saying it right, but Hasba, not necessarily how do you make it interesting, but like not as fearful in a way.
Yeah, that's,
right?
That's also a good point.
I feel like it is, you know, interesting topic, obviously, with medical aid and dying, or at least it's controversial. So like, I guess people, you know, some people might want to be interested in it. But yeah, how do you present some to where it's not as fearful and morbid and such, right? When you hear talking about death, it's like everyone all automatically thinks like, oh, morbidity and it's sad and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, no, what we're trying to do, or it seems like what you're trying to do, is show how powerful and beautiful and moving these opportunities are, even when facing death.
So I think that does not enter into my thoughts at all when I'm doing this, because when I Zoomed with the people that I chose from the storytellers, I picked them because they were, like you, very vital, smart, interesting people with a story that I'm personally interested in hearing. So I assume that everyone else is going to be like me and think that you're interesting and what you have to say is salient to the topic of medical aid and dying. So I feel like I have chosen who will be interesting to me and therefore interesting to you and to you. So it's like when I was doing Getting to the Nutcracker, I have a background in ballet. So when I went to the auditions for the kids that were auditioning for the Nutcracker, I can tell who was good and who I was going to follow and who might be interesting for the audience to watch and whose story might be kind of a cool one to follow. So I feel like this is more a gut instinct thing for me. Like I think that you're interesting, so I chose you to talk to, and turns out you were. And so the questions that I'm asking you are questions that I'm interested in knowing the answers to, and therefore I think other people might be interested in knowing the answers. So when I edit it, it will be with humor and with intelligence and with a beautiful film, because I feel like it has to look pretty too, and people have to appreciate the whole piece, the what's said, who's saying it, how it looks, how it sounds, the music that goes with it, and the graphics, that the stats that I can maybe put with it. It all comes together to be something that I think someone wants to see. And and if you know what the subject is, then you have that interest already. And I think if I can make the pilot good enough for people to want to see another story and then another story and then another, they're all going to be so different that hopefully I'll gain an audience for that.
Yeah, I think this is like one of those topics where it's also like relevant to people at certain points in their life. And I also think as a society, it's going to get like, it's going to peak at some point where it's going to be just like explode. And I feel like documentaries like yours are going to be needed. You know what I mean? They like need to be there at that time, mm-hmm. if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. And I think that will, I think there's just a lot of benefit people could have who are just experiencing maybe that time of their life.
Hopefully that it will touch people's hearts so that they'll have some compassion towards you and your story, and Trisha and her story, and Dana and her story, and Lee and her story, and Roger and his story, and all these people that we've talked to. You'll understand them and what they're going through in their heart, and how they are affecting change based on their own experiences. And hopefully it'll be interesting enough to have you come back and see the next one and then the next one. And
I had one more question kind of about the creative process. It seems like everybody that you've introduced me to, whether it's in your family, has like this creative desire, like this urge to just create. And I was just wondering, as a creative yourself, do you have like any advice for people about creativity, maybe about your creative process in like general, or maybe how you just see the creative field?
You're not the first person that said that. It's really interesting. I don't know. I mean, I just do what makes me happy. It's so much fun. No. You know, I'm not making any money. Documentaries don't make any money. Probably using a lot of money, of my own money too. I feel like it's just fun. I meet good people. I hear good stories, and I get to travel, and I get to give my opinion, which I really like to do. And I like to give my education, you know, what I've learned to other people. I mean, I've spoken at a university about it, and I've done other podcasts about it. I feel like it's fun, you know, and so my kids see what I'm doing and what Ray's doing. And it's an outlet, you know, it's creativity is an outlet, and it just makes you feel good. Can you imagine sitting behind a desk all day pushing numbers or something? I mean,
I've done both, and yeah.
Yeah, it's not my cup of tea, I don't think. You got a teacher desk, but I'm usually running around chasing after our crew.
Yeah.
I used to work at an advertising agency behind a desk, too. It didn't last long. It lasted a year or so.
Yeah. Creativity is just a really interesting topic in like general. Even every time we do one of these podcasts, I always feel like, you know,
it's infinite.
Yeah. It just, it's definitely like for me, this podcast has been like an outlet. Yeah.
It's fun.
Yeah. It's fun. It really is. And you always learn something new.
I think when you're doing a job that's fun, it doesn't feel like a job.
Yeah. Everyone wants to be Joe Rogan. Just talk for 3 hours and that's a job.
Serene, is there anything else you'd like to share with our listeners? Any parting words? Advice or anything that you'd like to share about the docuseries or about the topic of medical aid and dying?
It's not as scary as you think. It's actually quite peaceful and kind and humane. And if you can see that side of it from what I hope to show through the docuseries, then I've done my job.
Excellent.
I like it.
How's Vaughn? You got anything else for Serene?
No, just thank you for being on. I think the work you're doing, you and Ray, is actually really cool. And I think the world is going to benefit from it. I feel like this issue needed somebody like you to be there. And it's funny how everything connects and how you and Andrew are in this room right now. But yeah. That's really cool.
Well, it started, I guess, with my mom. Didn't pick me.
Yeah, it's amazing how this all seems to fit together. And again, that's how I take comfort, knowing that it's all part of the plan.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, thank you, Serene. Thanks for letting us be in your home and be a part of this and your documentary and docuseries. I can't wait to see how that all turns out. Just because I know everyone's going to be asking about it. Do you have any ballpark idea in terms of like a timeline when something like that might be released?
Well, the way I think at this time this will work is that I'll have to find a home for it. It'll either be a streaming service. Well, it will be a streaming service. And then it'll be up to them when they want to market it, you know, and put it out. It won't be up to me. If it were up to me, it'd be as soon as I'm done with it. But it's really, you know, wherever they can schedule it and no, I don't want to say that. Never mind. I'll tell you that afterwards.
Copy.
Some stuff can't be on the podcast.
Well, thank you again, Serene. We appreciate your time and can't wait for our listeners to listen to this episode and hear some of your cool stories.
Well, we'll put this in your episode.
Yeah.
At least part of it.
Yeah. Good stuff.
A lot of content.
Yeah. And make sure to all the listeners, check out our website. We'll certainly have information where you can see Serene's Outfeet First website and information about the docuseries. And she's got an awesome list of profiles of all the people who are involved, and it's very thorough. There's a great intro video. So all that information will be on our website available for you to check out. Give it a check. Yep. All right, friends, have a good one.
Take care.
birds singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You were only waiting for this moment to arrive. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these sunken eyes and learn to see all your life. You are only waiting for this moment to be free. Blackbird fly. Blackbird fly. Into the light of the dark black night. Blackbird fly. Blackbird fly. Into the light of the dark black night. Blackbird singing in the dead of night. Take these broken wings and learn to fly all your life. You're only waiting for this moment to arise. You are only waiting for this moment to arise. You are only waiting for this moment to arise.